This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we are joined by Hillary Levy Friedman. Hillary is an affiliate at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and was a Robert Wood Johnson Scholar on Health Policy. She is the author of Playing to Win, Raising Children in a Competitive Culture. Her piece, Tiger Girls on the Soccer Field, appears in the fall 2013 issue of Context magazine. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in your article, you compare three competitive youth practices that people usually don't place in the same context. So you talk about soccer, dance, and chess. I was wondering if we could start by you talking about how you came to have an interest in such a variety of competitive youth pursuits.
Yeah, well, it's a very good point that those three aren't often combined. And that's part of the point of Playing to Win, is that these activities that we might think of as so different actually have all these similarities. So the story of how I selected those three activities, though, goes back many years before, when I was actually doing a big research project on child beauty pageants. And I was finding all these interesting things that actually come to life even more in Playing to Win, but just the idea that kids at younger and younger ages are competing, the business practices behind these activities, et cetera. But everyone was like, oh my goodness, people in child beauty pageants are crazy. And I wasn't able to make those bigger points that I thought were going on in American childhood. So when I started my dissertation research, I said, okay, I want to pick activities that are more modal. So dance, for instance, most little girls or many little girls will have taken at least one dance class in their life. Soccer these days is said to be the most popular of all youth sports. More kids play soccer than any other new sport. And so that was sort of a starting point to say, let me pick one artistic activity, one athletic activity, and then one academic activity. And that sort of covers the range of the competitive after school activity experience possibilities. And there were also many things that went into it as well. So soccer, for example, is a team sport. Chess can be both. You can be part of a team, but it's really mainly an individual activity. And dance is the one that's really in the middle, because you can be a soloist or part of the group. And then in terms of sex, soccer is pretty equal between boys and girls. Dance is dominated almost exclusively by girls, and chess is dominated by boys. So those were some of the things that I was interested in. I knew I was interested in gender. I was interested in the team component. And so that's how those three came to be.
In your article, you didn't have much space to talk about the methods that you used. How did you go about doing this research?
So I did 16 months of field work. That was pretty much all I was doing. And so it was about, 7 to 9 months for each of the activities. There was an overlap when I would start a new activity and finish one. I started with chess because I actually knew nothing about chess. I didn't know how the pieces moved or anything. So I started there because I knew I had the steepest learning curve. And for instance, there it was like I was hanging out at a summer chess camp. I got a chance to meet teachers and coaches. I got a chance to meet the kids. And then I got a chance to meet a lot of the parents at pick up and drop off. And then I learned about tournaments, other programs, that sort of thing. And I followed a similar pattern with soccer, hanging out at practices. The same thing with dance. I worked with two specific dance studios. So I had six field sites overall, three in the same urban setting and three in the same suburban setting. And so after hanging out for a while, I did semi-structured interviews with parents, children, and teachers and coaches. I did 172 interviews in all. And that's, it was a lot of field work, a lot of talking to people, a lot of hanging out. I say it was like I had kids. I do have a child now with another on the way, but at the time I didn't. So I got a taste of having very full evenings and weekends while I was in my mid-20s.
So it was like shadowing someone before you join a profession.
Exactly. And it's given me a lot. It gave me a lot to think about what I was looking for in a family, in a marriage with kids and all those things. So it's actually proved very helpful, not just professionally, but personally as well.
Yeah. So what did you find out about the motivations that the parents had and how that might have differed by the three practices?
So in general, all of the parents I met across the three activities, they really want the best for their kids, and they're making these decisions based on the long-term futures they think they're preparing their kids for. Of course, the way they choose to do that might work in very different ways. So specifically when we think about girls, and especially when we think about differences between dance and soccer, which are both physical activities, a lot of parents would turn to that first. Oh, I wanted her to be physically active, that sort of thing. But still, choosing between soccer and dance, those are different choices, artistic versus athletic, that sort of thing. So one of the things that came out in my analysis was that a lot of the parents of the dance girls, you know, while most could be considered middle class broadly defined, there was sort of a lower middle class, and there were a few actual working class families in the dance world that I met. Whereas with soccer, nearly everyone would be considered upper middle class. And the way that they spoke about the futures that they think they're preparing their girls for differed greatly. So the professions they think they're preparing their kids for, the attributes that they think are necessary for their girls to be successful, you know, being aggressive versus being supportive, and those sorts of things differed greatly.
Mm-hmm. So in the article, you use the term competitive kid capital. What do you mean by that?
So when kids participate in any after-school activity, they're developing specific skills. So that might be teamwork, that might be learning the importance of practice, of sticking with something, that sort of thing. But when you take it to the competitive level, when you go beyond just recreational participation, you're getting something different out of the experience. So based on my interviews with parents, I identified five different elements that I label competitive kid capital. So these include learning that there's going to be records kept. You know, a lot of recreational soccer games, even though the kids know the score, they say, oh, we're not keeping score. And, you know, no one writes it down what the score was. Whereas if you're playing in a travel soccer league, that goes on the internet. You know, you want to see how you did over the season, if you make the playoffs, that sort of thing. With chess, very similar. It's not just going to be what happened when you were in class or at summer camp that day. When you play in a chess tournament, literally anyone can go on the website and look you up and see your entire tournament history. So kids learn, okay, it matters if I win or lose, for example. You also learn how to come back from a public loss to succeed in the future. So while a lot of people think this is just about winning, sometimes you only really learn about winning by experiencing a loss. So these are different elements of competitive kid capital. The other elements include performing under time pressure, performing in stressful situations, and under the gaze of others.
Could you say a little bit more about how the activities reveal different ideas of how children, or particularly girls in this case, should act and the qualities that are valued, both by the parents and society?
So obviously when you're thinking about dance, especially if you've ever seen the show Dance Moms, you know that it's important to be talented and have skills, but how you look also matters, your costume, your hair, your makeup. So with dance, you're getting a bit of that message to girls. Hey, you know, look put together, or, you know, hey, look really girly and look glitzy and all of those sorts of things. Whereas in soccer, that's totally de-emphasized. For safety reasons, you remove all jewelry, your hair is pulled back, but even the uniforms, you know, they're basically the same thing as what the boys wear. So, you know, the appearance, the feminine appearance in particular, is very de-emphasized. So that sort of matters long-term for girls as well. And also this idea of being aggressive and assertive. So in soccer, you know, when you have a game, there's pretty much always a winner and a loser. There might be a tie, but you're head-to-head against a particular opponent. Whereas in dance, dance competitions work on what's called the adjudication system. So everyone leaves a competition having been recognized in some way. Your routine might be evaluated as getting a silver or a gold or a diamond or a platinum, and you get a ribbon that corresponds to that. And then at the end of that, you know, you're ranked, okay, you know, all the routines overall or against all the other tap routines or jazz routines. So there is still a ranking, but you're not head to head in the same way. And it's more of a subjective interpretation. And so those are very different life lessons as well. You know, to be competitive in the classroom or in the workplace in a more assertive or one-on-one way that you get from soccer is very different from sort of, while dance girls can be very competitive, of course, there's also an element of clapping and saying someone looked good or did a good job and being more supportive.
So how do these different gendered expectations relate to the class position of both the parents and children? I know in the article you made an argument that they're woven together. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so especially when you think about the soccer parents who are raising these girls to be very aggressive and assertive in the classroom, in the workplace, on the field, a lot of them are talking about careers in investment banking, in big law firms. These are careers that the parents themselves have had, have identified these activities as ones they look for in hiring. And so you can see a lot of class reproduction going on there.
Did the parents actually explicitly say that, you know, here's a skill that they learn in soccer and here's a skill that they can use later in life? Or did it just seem like they were drawn to those type of skills?
It's more of a signal for what it, you know, symbolizes. And then they talk about specific types of skills. There wasn't always for all families a one-to-one like, oh, you learned this skill and this will help you be a successful investment banker. It's more over the course of the hour and a half conversation, they identified those skills and then also identified investment banking or being a lawyer and that sort of thing. Some parents were very explicit, but most, you know, were talking about these not in as strategic of a way as some parents, but clearly there was some strategy involved and they knew that these were the types of skills that you would need if you wanted to pursue that type of career. Of course, not everybody does and not everybody will.
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing to think about when you're looking at something like soccer, which is supposed to be a leisure activity where kids get a chance to play and have fun, and yet you're already talking about the skills that could lead to being a successful investment banker or something like that.
Well, that's part of the thing. You know, these aren't just leisure activities. Are there leisure activities that are masquerading as a form of children's work? I have an article I wrote in Childhood that actually compares the child beauty pageant kids to children that do a lot of after-school math enrichment classes. And I make this argument that children's after-school activities can be thought of as a form of children's work these days, that instead of going to work on the farm or in the factory, kids are now developing these skills that are thought to be necessary to succeed in our economy, the way it works today, our information economy, that sort of thing. And so these hours between schooling and home and the family have become an integral part of preparing kids for a later stage in life. And we should think of them as a form of work, even though they can be fun. There are many work-like elements.
That's fascinating. So what did you see when you looked specifically at chess and dance?
Well, there's not a lot of overlap in the chess and dance world. There's far more overlap between chess and soccer. So chess and soccer have a lot more similarities, even though soccer is more physical. Chess, again, has that one-to-one competitive aspect, that aggressive aspect. So there are similarities there. And there are a lot of similarities in the class backgrounds, particularly of the parents of girls when it comes to chess and soccer. The picture is a bit more complicated when you include the boys, because chess overall actually is the most diverse of the activities I studied. And I would venture to guess, you know, we don't really keep representative numbers on this, but chess is definitely one of the most diverse of all competitive kids after school activities, precisely because it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. And when you sit down to play at a tournament, it's just your brain that matters. Where when you think about dance, the cost of the costumes and the shoes and the travel and all of that. So chess has a bit of a democratizing element, but not quite when it comes to the girls. And it definitely in the communities and the family I met, that wasn't true. So there's not a lot of overlap between the dance and the chess, and we can think of chess and soccer in similar ways. Now, the one difference between the chess and the soccer, because chess isn't a physical activity, girls, there's more space to be a different kind of girl. So you can be the princess, the pink, the rhinestones. You could go play, you know, a chess tournament in a tiara and that's okay. Or you could not, not wear a dress, not do all those sorts of things. But there's the space to be what I call a pink warrior girl in chess in ways that there aren't in other activities.
Do you think there's more class divisions in what children do with their free time now versus looking at past generations?
I do, because of the pay-to-play structure that we have. And so the rise of the organized, adult-run, pay-to-play activities has crowded a lot of kids out at the younger ages. When you get to high school, the picture looks a little bit different because of many school-based, scholastic-based opportunities. But when you're looking at the elementary school age, which is where the focus of playing to win is, there's a big division because they're so expensive and not everyone has access to the same resources.
Okay. Would you mind sharing one or two takeaway points or lessons that this teaches us about the larger idea of reproduction of class in the United States?
So first of all, I think the idea that there are classed forms of femininity is very important. And we used to think of the arts as being the province of the elite and the more upper class. And what we're seeing, especially for more affluent young girls, is a focus on athletics in a way that athletics have been quite important for males and for the elite over the years. And this is starting to impact girls as well. So those are two really important things to remember and to think about moving forward. That, you know, girls in more affluent elite families are being treated in similar ways to their brothers, and that makes for a change. But certainly these activities are a form of class reproduction. Parents are being strategic. The lessons that kids get the opportunity to develop this competitive kid capital translates into later in the educational system, later into the workforce as well. And so it's not just what's happening in the classroom that matters, it's the development of these skills outside of the classroom as well that has long-term implications for inequality.
Okay, and then to conclude, perhaps the most important question, if people want to learn more about this and find more of your research and writing, where would they look?
So you can go to my website, hilarylevyfriedman.com. It's HilarylevyFriedman. I have lots of writings there, press coverage. I try to blog at least twice a month. And hopefully that's a good resource. And of course, you should buy the book because there's a lot more on this and many other topics in the book that will be of interest to sociologists, professional sociologists, grad students, and especially undergrads, because this is a topic that a lot of undergraduates can relate to. It's similar to their own experience. And so it gives them a way to look at their lives and backgrounds in a different lens.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. That was great. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Great. Thanks so much. I look forward to hearing it when it goes up.
This is for the doers, the repeaters.